Welcome back to Exploring Jewish Thought with Afroni Schlesinger. The question that we're going to be tackling now is the question of why God created the world. As I was going through the various approaches, and the primary approaches that I'd like to spend most of the time on are the approaches of the Maharal, the Ramchal, and Rav Kook, although there are other approaches such as the Ramban, and we see approaches in Rashi and in Pirkei Avot. They come in the form of statements, just pretty clear-cut statements, whereas the Maharal, the Ramchal, and Rav Kook really elaborate upon those, some of them very closely related to their predecessors, but they elaborate on them as very deep ideas and ask kind of more of the questions that we would like to ask to get a better perspective on the topic. But as I was going through them, what I noticed is that there are so many ideas and relevant contexts to that first need to be understood and appreciated before really it makes any sense to be talking about the different approaches to why God created the world. I just think there are a lot of questions that need to be asked. We need to understand why we're asking this question, what this question is, what our chance of getting any sort of real answer to it is, and then we need to understand, given the answers that we get, what does that mean for us? How are we supposed to adapt those answers into our practice? So this first podcast is going to be an introduction primarily to the topic of why God created the world. And the second one will be to go through those three approaches that I mentioned. And the two of those together, I hope to paint a relatively clear picture, but one that is practical, one that gives a little bit of insight into what this information is and what it means to us and how it should be adapted into our lives. So the first thing that needs to be acknowledged, which is not particular to the question of why God created the world, rather to most topics that we're going to be discussing, which is establishing the fact that we don't know. We don't know. We don't know. We probably never will know entirely, at least for certain. But using our various texts and traditions, as well as our analytical skills, we're able to produce some sort of understanding that may not be wrong, just a fraction of the actual picture. But when we deal with questions of why we do mitzvot, and we integrate all the answers that we have, or why did God create the world, regardless of the amount of time that we spend analyzing this topic, we will never know with 100% certainty why God created the world, and nor should we ever assume that the answer we've come up with is even close to the entire picture that God understands if he were to contemplate the exact same question. So that's a fact that needs to be established probably in for every question that you're going to ask in the realms of why God did something or asked us to do something. There's a lot that we don't understand, and we can do our very best, and we have a responsibility to do our very best. If you recall the Rambam's perspective on why we do mitzvot, he really called for a better attempt to understand these things, and perhaps by extension or because we are created in the image of God, that gives us some inherent connectability, some inherent perceptibility of why God would do these things. So to a certain degree, they will make sense to us. But in their entirety, we'll never fully understand, we'll never fully grasp the entire picture. The next thing to address, which is going to be it's a point of frustration for most people, in both in the realms of halacha, of, you know, particular law and particular practice, as well as machshava, as well as the philosophical realm. And that's the idea of multiple views, because I think what most people believe that they want is one answer that makes things make sense. If, you know, just to hear the Rambam's perspective on mitzvot and then to assume, well, I guess that's why we do mitzvot, and anything beyond that and certainly contradictory to it is counterintuitive. It gives me less clarity. If the Rambam were correct, then I would understand why we do mitzvot. Now that I have two legitimate, or three or four or five or six legitimate perspectives on why we do mitzvot, so now I don't know why I do mitzvot, and I'm, you know, I'm very uncertain. And the more opinions that seem to be out there, the less confident I am with my understanding of the topic. I think that's what people want, but I'm not sure if people realize that the degree to which that holds you back from actually understanding the topic in any significant or meaningful way, right? Because as we just said a moment ago, we don't know, we never will know, because our knowledge and ability to perceive these topics is so far from God's ability to perceive these topics that we could only ever achieve a fraction of the truth. But granted that our perspectives are being developed through a legitimate process and from legitimate sources, I'm not talking about someone locked themselves in a room one day and came up with a new answer to why we do mitzvot, or why we, or why God created the world, or similar questions to that. I'm talking about people who look to the sources that are God-given, or else long-standing traditions from prophets or from the you know, earliest halachic minds, people who look to them as the sources for the answers to these questions, and go about developing an idea properly. So they will have a legitimate view. They'll have a legitimate perspective on the matter and a legitimate answer to this question. So what that means is that anything that comes through a proper process and based on a proper source is not just a legitimate view in a sense, but it is a partially correct view in a sense, or it is a completely correct view, but it is part of the greater picture of views. Because what multiple viewpoints that all come from the same source give us is it helps us reach beyond the knowledge of one person opposite the knowledge of God. Meaning, if you had to take Rambam's perspective on every single question, what you have is God has his reasons for whatever he does or whatever he asks us to do, and he conveyed a good bit of those reasons to us through the Torah, through the oral law, through various traditions from Moshe. So he conveyed that to us, and now we're relying on one man, the Rambam, to convey to us the entirety of what God may have had in mind by what he did or what he said or what he asked us to do. So that limits God's mind or reasons to one individual's ability to perceive them. Now, it's not as though two individuals' ability to perceive them gets you all that much closer to God. However, it does get you significantly beyond where one person could, given that they go through a proper process. So when you have the Rambam and the Ramban's perspective, what you need to remember is they're not necessarily arguing, or perhaps it seems that they are, but their argument is not necessarily an I'm right, you're wrong argument. Rather, if both of these ideas can be supported within the Torah, then there is an element of truth that exists in both of them. And if that element of truth that the Ramban points out, the Rambam didn't mention or didn't understand or didn't see or didn't necessarily even agree with, perhaps he did realize it and just didn't agree with it, but it came from the Torah, then it is legitimate and it does have an element of truth in it, and therefore it gives you more of a clear picture, or more of a correct, or more of a holistic picture rather, than the Rambam himself could have done. So it's these, this is the Maharal speaks about this at length in his Be'er HaGola, I believe it's in the first chapter, that the function of multiple opinions within halacha and within philosophy is that any opinion that is rooted in the Torah is true to a certain degree, in which case if you only had one opinion, you would have a more simple direction for how you must act, but you would have a significantly worse picture of the truth. So to give an example for that, when you think about perhaps the Heinz dilemma, right? So the Heinz dilemma is about stealing medicine that you can't afford to save a loved one's life. Now, it's interesting. I found out after I was familiar with the Heinz dilemma, that's actually a machloket Rashi Tosvot in Masechet Bava Kama, I believe, as to whether or not you're allowed to do that. So it's very interesting that this debate has predated Heinz perhaps and been discussed amongst, you know, the top Jewish scholars for years now. But that's the idea. Now, what makes this a dilemma, and this is something that my grandfather, was both a rabbi and had his doctorate in philosophy, he used to say a lot about ethical dilemmas. Ethical dilemmas is not when there is a clear right answer that you're having trouble choosing for one reason or another. Ethical dilemmas are when you have two possibilities, both with good characteristics and bad characteristics, and you know you're going to have to choose one and give up the good in the other one and accept the bad in the one that you're doing. And that's the idea of a true ethical dilemma. So it could be, I don't know, it could be in whatever ideological or legal system, whatever debate that you have, you conclude that the correct answer is you steal the medicine. You know, that is the ethical thing to do, is to steal the medicine to save the loved one's life. That could be, and maybe you're confident in that conclusion. But what's important to mention is that doesn't make stealing right. Right? It justifies it. That it doesn't mean that there was nothing wrong in what you did. It just means that your actions were justifiable. Perhaps the bad of not doing it overwhelmed the bad of doing it, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So if you're having this dilemma if you're having a debate regarding the Heinz dilemma and you are unable to see the other side, or you are unable to see the wrongness of stealing in that scenario, and you can only see that you should be stealing, and you do not understand the argument to say that you should, or not even don't understand the argument, you don't understand what would be bad about stealing, then while you may have the correct answer, you may have the ethical answer to a certain degree, you're certainly lacking a larger picture of truth, because you lack an understanding of how bad stealing is. So if you can't say that I concluded ethically you should steal this, but stealing is still wrong, if you don't understand that stealing is wrong, perhaps maybe if you don't understand it at all, meaning if you're someone who completely justifies theft, right? And in this scenario, you happen to get lucky in that theft is actually the more ethical choice. But if you can't see that theft is wrong, you may be right in this scenario, but you're definitely missing a much larger picture of ethics. You may be right in this one case, and that's very convenient as far as this one case goes, but you certainly should not ignore the fact that the theft that you had to perpetrate was a reason not to do it and a significant reason not to do it. And then on the other side, if you would say, no, you cannot steal, this isn't your property, and nothing can justify theft, then there may be, to a certain degree, a value of life or a recognition for the inherent value of life that you're missing. And so even if you're right that you shouldn't steal it, perhaps that is the ethically correct choice, you're missing of the value of life. And practically, you may be spot on, but that doesn't mean that you have the proper picture of the dilemma in this scenario. So when you are able to see it from both sides, even if one of them practically is the correct answer, you definitely gain a larger picture of the truth, and not and a truer picture. I mean, of the truth. This is. If you fail to acknowledge the pros and cons of each side, then you're missing more of the truth, and that exists within halacha and it exists within philosophy. Meaning, if there's a debate as to whether or not something is ritually pure or ritually impure, at the end of the day, we're going to paskin. We're going to determine that one of them is the correct answer. And if you touch that thing and it's ritually impure, you become impure. It's an absolute. You are absolutely impure. There's no way around that. Whereas if we deem that it were ritually pure, then absolutely you are pure. There's no problem. You don't have to do anything in case of a doubt. So, but we arrived at that conclusion based on a method of determining that we were given by God, perhaps of majority, right? We were told that if you have multiple opinions, then you follow the majority and that becomes the correct answer. But that's not to say that if six people thought this was ritually impure and four people thought that it was pure, that there was no legitimacy to the argument of the four. Now, what that means is that perhaps things are not entirely pure or entirely impure. There are causes, there are influential factors in the purity of things and influential factors in the impurity of things. Now, this is, when you're adding up those factors and when you're analyzing those factors, you may come to the conclusion that this is a greater likelihood given the present factors of being impure. But that's not to say that there are present factors that would cause it to seemingly be pure. So you can't rule out the existence of the contradictory factors that are going to change its legal status. At the end of the day, we need an absolute manner of determining the law. And that's why we follow the majority. And once six as opposed to four, or even two as opposed to one, say that it's impure, it becomes absolutely impure. But that's not to say necessarily that that they were absolutely right and the dissenting opinion was absolutely wrong. And that comes up perhaps most in a most appalling manner when it comes to a debate that God himself seemingly weighed in upon, right? So there was a debate between a certain oven which was broken and put back together, and the question is, well, if it's a complete intact vessel, it can contract ritual impurity, but if it's a broken vessel, it cannot. And so the debate was whether or not this is fully intact and can contract ritual impurity, or is it broken? Is it a broken vessel which cannot contract ritual impurity? Now the rabbis have this debate, and one rabbi is so convinced that he is correct that he said that a bat kol, basically a heavenly voice, should come out and determine the law, and the heavenly voice rules in his favor. And we say that's very nice, except that's not how we determine halacha. So our determining of halacha, even in a scenario where we knew that God had a dissenting opinion, so to speak, we don't follow that, because we know that there is truth to both sides. We also know that there is fallacy, perhaps, to both sides, or error in both sides, or at least, you know, not in God's, in the case where God weighs in, but we know that there is truth to both sides. That's not the question. The question is, practically, how do we go about determining what our actions should be when both sides have merits? And that is a majority. So essentially, what having multiple opinions helps us to achieve is, even though on the surface it seems more confusing to have to contend with multiple seeming and very likely contradictory viewpoints, if they come from a godly source, then what we're actually seeing is two people tapping into a larger picture of truth that God understands in what way these two ideas are not contradictory and in what ways these two ideas can be maintained. Your average one person probably cannot see in what way both of these ideas that seem to be contradictory are different sides of the same truth. And therefore, having two opinions that are sourced in Torah or in tradition give us a better picture at how God actually sees this topic. So that's important to keep in mind when we talk about the reasons for mitzvot, or when we speak about the why God created the world, is we're going to have multiple different views. Now, even if the rabbis themselves saw their views as mutually exclusive one from the other, if their process has been deemed as valid, then they're essentially both tapping into two different ways that God wished to convey to us that there was purpose in creating the world. And perhaps each one of the rabbis was only able to see the legitimacy in his own perspective, but we as the onlookers can take both opinions and gain a bit better of a picture of the truth than relying entirely on one person would have given us. That's kind of the introduction, in the sense that that's the context that we're going to need to understand everything within. But one critical question that needs to kind of be asked which will accompany the question of why God created the world was, what was God missing? Which is a difficult question to ask. It's kind of a controversial question to ask, because how can you say that God was missing anything? But this is a necessary question to ask, because if he created something outside of himself, then he was missing that thing, seemingly. If he created something outside of him, why did he need to create it? Or if he didn't need to create it, then why did he create it? Did he want to? Did he need to? And what did he not already have that creating this thing helped him with? So what was he missing, in a sense? Now, I think you can give an easy answer and just say, well, it wasn't for him, it was for us. I mean, he wasn't missing anything, he didn't need anything, he didn't necessarily want anything, but this was a positive, this is a net gain for us, the creations. And that, you're going to run into an issue, because there's a Gemara in Erevin, where essentially Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai debate this topic of, was it good for us to be created? It's probably a topic that should be given more time and attention than a quick comment in a podcast about something else. But Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai debate, was it good for us to be created? Was it good for human beings to be created? Should I have been, you know, happy that I was given this opportunity to live in the world? Or was it essentially bad for us to be created? Was it unfortunate, kind of a detriment? We were given a test with an overwhelming chance of failure, whereas if we weren't given that test at all, our position, our situation would most likely be better. Now, what's interesting is that, well, you know, it was a debate to a certain degree, but the conclusion of that debate is that at the end of the day, they both came to the reasoning that it was bad for it was bad is a difficult word. It was not advantageous for us to be created. It was not advantageous for creations to have been created. Therefore, now that we're in this scenario, there are a few things that we could be doing, namely listening to God, pursuing His commandments, and following in the path that He laid out toward us, that helps us better our situation and turn what was most likely a disadvantageous situation into and more than a neutral one, but actually an advantageous one. So we have the opportunity to make it into a good thing, but on average, based on, I guess, the percentage of failure, it was most likely a bad thing. And so, again, that's a topic that probably needs its own focus, but it does undermine, to a certain degree, this idea that we were created for us, for our own benefit, and therefore God wasn't missing anything. Seemingly, we were not created for our own benefit. We were created out of necessity to accomplish some other purpose, much to our misfortune, perhaps, even, or misfortune, perhaps. So we have to understand what exactly that purpose was and why it was necessary to inconvenience us, so to speak, with the burden of being created, which is an interesting way of looking at it, but maybe a brutally honest way. And the third point I think that needs to be addressed is, what is our role? Now, that's a natural outshoot of the question that I just asked, because once you have understood that there is a reason behind your creation, then you have a role, right? You have a mission. You have a certain tafkid, or a certain expected part to play in that reason for which you were created. And that's going to be a question that regardless of the answer that you give to why the world was created and therefore why human beings were created, that's going to necessitate what human beings should be doing. And there are two aspects to the what is our role question. There is A, performing our proper function, and B, feeling meaningful, right? And so the first one is kind of a question of lishma, of doing things purely for the reason that they are correct. Meaning, what if you got absolutely nothing out of this? You just believed in the mission with all of your heart and your soul, and so you committed yourself to it. Now, there are missions like that, you know, I'm sure we're familiar with, that aside from perhaps feeling good about ourselves, we'd commit ourselves to because we just thought it was that critical, right? If the mission was, let's end world hunger, and this was your crusade. I mean, this was what you thought was just the most important pressing issue of our time, and you thought we were able to end world hunger, and you committed your life to that, your concern wouldn't necessarily be, what am I getting out of this? Why am I doing this? What does this help me with? How is it even impacting me? Your concern may be, the biggest, most important thing in the world is ending world hunger. I am a pawn in solving that problem. So similarly, you can see your role in, or your tafkid, your purpose in the world, in a very similar vein. So what I mean by that is, if when we take the answer of, well, why were you created, your role becomes directly related to why you were created, right? Because doing what you were created for becomes, I guess, probably the most basic understanding of your role. Now, we can understand what that does for you, or you can identify with that purpose so powerfully that you simply want it accomplished. Now, if world hunger, which is a very, you know, ending world hunger, obviously a very important and, you know, valiant task or aspiration, which is determined by your own mind as something that's, you know, imperative, then the purpose, or the creating the world and the purpose that the world was created for, which was seemingly what God determined was most important. Seemingly, I mean, if you're being, if you trust in God and you believe in the answer, or you trust the source by which we arrived at that answer, you would have to say that that, whatever that reason is probably the most important thing in the universe, right? Because if you have concluded that ending world hunger is important, and therefore you're willing to commit yourself to it, you know, regardless of what you gain from it, then if creating the world and putting you in it was what God determined was absolutely necessary, well, then you should probably trust his judgment at least as much as you trust your own, but most likely you should probably trust it more so. So that idea of doing it lishma, simply acting in the world as God asks of you because he created you to perform a role, and that is of absolute, of the highest level of importance, because God determined that it was absolutely necessary. He wouldn't have created you, or he wouldn't have created the world if we could have done without a world, and he couldn't have created you if he could have done this without you. It becomes absolutely necessary. And once it's absolutely necessary, it's the most important thing that exists in your life. So what would be the most lishma, or the most proper method of performance, is just to acknowledge that whatever God is asking you to do is actually more, in reality, is more important than anything that you can think is important. Right? God has determined that this was absolutely necessary. Anything that you've determined is important or necessary probably pales in comparison to what God has determined is absolutely necessary. So if God created you and gave you a series of responsibilities, that those responsibilities are probably more important than anything that you can fathom or anything that you have determined is important. In which case, regardless of what you get out of it, you should strive to cancel out or at least allow those responsibilities to overwhelm any perception that you had of what is important that lies outside those responsibilities, because that is what it means to trust in God. So even if you are promised, meaning if you are in theory, I'm not saying this is practical or easy, in theory, if you are told regardless of what you do, you're going to burn in hell for all eternity, but you trust that God's determination of what is important is going to be better than your own, and God asks you to do something, well, you wouldn't say, well, who cares? I'm burning in hell anyway. I might as well do what I want. You would say, my perception of importance is nothing compared to God's perception of importance, and so I believe that what he deemed important is more important than anything that I could possibly fathom, and therefore I will do it just for that sake. And that might be one of the most difficult and most selfless, but probably one of the most accurate motivating forces in performing mitzvot, or just listening to God, realizing that your own perception of importance pales in comparison to God's, and then God created you for a reason and gave you a list of responsibilities. And whatever performing those responsibilities accomplishes, it is more important that that be accomplished than anything that you could possibly fathom. And regardless of what you're getting out of it, that is more important than anything else in the world. That's going to be factor number one of performing mitzvot or performing your function, operating upon your role lishma, not for your own personal benefit, but just because logically you assume that God's God's definition of important is better and more accurate than your own, and this is what God deemed as necessary, and that makes it far more important than any alternative task or mission that you could ever fathom. And the second one is a sense of meaning. Right, feeling meaningful. What does it mean to feel meaningful? Well, it turns out that to feel meaningful, you should probably be behaving in the way that you were created for. Now, if you don't believe in God and you don't believe that that you were created for a specific purpose, then I guess, you know, you could either conclude that everything is meaningless and therefore inconsequential, or you can just believe that importance and meaning is derived from decisions, and you can decide to be meaningful, you can decide to be important, and you decide what is important and what to do. I don't really buy into the latter, because I think that it's that I think that determining your purpose doesn't necessarily give it objective value. It may give it subjective value in your own eyes, but I personally believe that real true value comes from acting in the way that you were put here to act. And that would assume that God created the world and put you in it for a specific reason. So what that means is that if there was a function that you were expected to play, the most meaningful existence that you could ever experience is performing that function, because it is by definition, the most meaningful thing that you can do is by definition the thing that you are brought here to do. And performing any other function is not nearly as meaningful, because it's self-elected meaning, as opposed to an objective meaning, which is God determined that you have the skill set to perform the following responsibilities that he needs performed, right? If you're hired as a doctor in a hospital, you're the best surgeon, let's say in the country, and you're hired as a surgeon in a hospital, and you notice that the bathrooms are dirty, and so you spend all day cleaning the bathrooms, what you're doing may be important, but you'll never feel as fulfilled cleaning bathrooms when you are the best surgeon in the country, because you're not doing what you were brought here to do, and B, you're not executing the fullest extent of your potential given your particular unique skill set. So performing the function you were created for is by definition the most meaningful that you could ever feel. And that is, for some people who have never felt that in a foreign experience, and some people who haven't felt that may not even believe it exists. Again, no conclusive causation has ever been determined in these things, but I've read at least in a number of different sources, a number of people have suggested a casual at least correlation between. Suicide and depression in Western countries, and a lack of some sort of religious objective moral guidance. And you know, it's fascinating to just to point out that on an objective level, our living standards are higher, and our amenities and our luxuries are higher and more advanced than any other civilization in human history, and yet our rates of depression and suicide are also are either higher or at least rival some of the highest rates in human history. And you could wonder how that could possibly be, that life could ever be so good, and yet it seems to be intolerable for so many people. So I've heard it suggested to link the two. I've never actually seen it conclusively proven in any study, or even, you know, strongly through any wide study. But the idea, I think, is a powerful one to consider nonetheless, in that when you lose an objective sense of meaning, you realize that you're not a very good production system for meaning. You can't necessarily successfully choose what you mean and what is important. You may change your mind every day. You may pursue something and leave it, or you may spend your entire life pursuing something that is ultimately not very important. Now that may or may not be the case. Again, this is not something that I've thought up. This is something that I've heard and suggested a number of times, but I think the point is worthy of considering either way, is that objective purpose, it would stand to reason, at least in my eyes, objective purpose, living your life feeling as though you are living out an objective purpose would seem to be a far more meaningful existence than assuming you get to determine what you mean and then acting upon that. A, because it's subjective, you determined what you mean, what you meant, as opposed to God determining what you mean. And B, because it's only as meaningful as your ability at the time, as your perceptive skills are at the time. I mean, when you're 10 years old, the most meaningful thing that you could think of might be getting the highest grade in the class. Now, that's not objectively very meaningful at all, in a sense, but that's where you're at. So you could never pursue meaning beyond your perception, which is very, very limiting. Whereas if you pursue a meaning that is based on God's understanding of meaning, then you obviously are pursuing something that is far beyond even where you would ever assume to be. And one beautiful thing that I find in religious growth is that when you've been doing things your entire life, and maybe they make sense to you on some level while you do them and maybe not, but they seem to increase in the meaning that they give you rather than decrease very often. At least I feel this in my own life. And perhaps the reason for that is because what I'm doing is infinitely meaningful, meaning it is meaningful and significant and important as deemed by an infinite being, as deemed by God. I could never fully understand, but through growth and through maturity and through exploration of Judaism and Jewish thought, I can understand more, and therefore I will tap into, or I'll get a slightly better picture of just how meaningful what I'm already doing is. And it's kind of this cycle, or rather this growth process that never ceases to give you more reasons to be in love with what you're doing and to value what you're doing, because you're doing something infinitely important. You're doing something of importance that you cannot possibly fathom or ever fully appreciate. And therefore, so through your life, you're just going through a process of realizing more and more the significance of what you're already doing. And it's an unbelievable feeling. It's an unbelievable sense of meaning. So I'll just break that up into, three quick categories, which is to say, I think that achieving or that acting in a way that is meaningful is what that means is to understand why God created the world and then why he put you in it, and then live your life in a way that most closely reflects the responsibilities that God gave you for achieving the purpose for which you were created. And that, I think, breaks down into the you, the Jew, and the person, right? Now, I put Jew as an independent category by extension of the fact that because we have so many more responsibilities. So there's the you is in what way you are unique and you are different than every single person in the world. That will have a lot to do with what you're supposed to be doing. And then in what ways you have more responsibilities than everyone else. And then just at you as a person, the fact that you exist, the fact that God thought to create you, gives you intrinsic value and intrinsic meaning and intrinsic purpose. And that perspective is also, kind of derech agav, just as a side point, a brief window into why it is that Judaism is a religion that does not require everyone in the world to follow its instructions, because ultimately we believe that the world was created for a reason, and the people in the world were created to carry out that reason. There must be a division of labor and a certain a set of responsibilities, but as long as they're being accomplished, I mean, that's the main objective, in which case it's not imperative that everyone, and not only not imperative, it's perhaps counterintuitive that everyone would be given the same list of responsibilities or the same amount of responsibilities. So when you look at them, when you look at the mitzvot as the commandments, not necessarily as objective manifestations of moral behavior, anything that isn't a mitzvah is immoral, anything that is a mitzvah is moral, rather a series of responsibilities in achieving your purpose in the world, what you get what you get is a bit of an understanding of why not everyone needs to follow the mitzvot. It's not imperative that everyone has those responsibilities. The responsibilities that you have is an extension of who you are as a person, for what reason God created you, and in which case your reason to be created may not involve these mitzvot and these set of responsibilities. If you are a Jew, by definition, your reason for being created cannot be accomplished without achieving those responsibilities. So that was the introduction to why God created the world. I think that once now we go into the actual different approaches, the Maharal, the Ramchal, and Rav Kook, who I want to focus on most primarily, we'll be able to put them into a context that is very helpful and eye-opening and practical. We'll be able to understand how their view on why God created the world impacts our significance as creations in the world and impacts our role and our responsibility and our own pursuit of meaning within that larger framework.